What is the most frequent metaphor that Jesus uses for the kingdom of God? Believe it or not, it's money. This includes the parable of the talents, the parable of the lost coin, or the parable of the unforgiving servant. God also prescribed financial advice for the children of Israel and the church, though some of it requires a little digging to find it. What would a godly economy look like? Would it resemble capitalism? Socialism? Would it look like a combination of the two? Or something else entirely? What are God's prescriptions, and how can we apply them today? How might they be beneficial to us today and in the future? God's economy observes cycles. And what are these cycles? God made prescriptions for every day, for regular cycles of days, for every year, and for regular cycles of years. And once we review the components of God's economy, let's look at how it anticipates and counters the faults of human economies. Let's turn to Exodus 22. Exodus 22, and we'll start in verse 25. What are the economic prescriptions for every day? Exodus 22, starting in verse 25. If you loan money to one of my people who is poor, you are not to deal with him as you would a creditor, and you are not to charge him interest. If you take your neighbor's coat as collateral, you are to restore it to him by sundown, because it's his only garment. He needs it to wrap his body. What else does he have in which to sleep? Moreover, if he cries out to me, I will listen, because I am compassionate. This introduces a key concept of God's economy: take care of the downtrodden. Let's turn to Leviticus 25. Leviticus 25, starting in verse 35. If a member of your people has become poor so that he can't support himself among you, you are to assist him as you would a foreigner or a temporary resident, so that he can continue living with you. Do not charge him interest or otherwise profit from him, but fear your God so that your brother can continue living with you. Do not take interest when you loan him money, or take a profit when you sell him food. God's economy is compassionate. How many of you have ever gone and gotten a payday loan? My employer's president found out that several of his employees were reliant on payday loans to make ends meet. He got a call from one of these establishments asking to garnish the wages of one of his employees. What they wanted from each paycheck wouldn't even cover the fees that accrued every pay period. They would be garnishing this person's wages indefinitely. In response, the president used the company's capital to set up a non-predatory in-house payday loan program. Besides, if your neighbor is in such need that you would be taking his coat as collateral, what is that coat worth to you? Let's look at Matthew 5 and put that in this context. Matthew 5, verse 39. Matthew 5, verse 39. But I tell you not to stand up against someone who does you wrong. On the contrary, if someone hits you on the right cheek, let him hit you on the left cheek too. If someone wants to sue you for your shirt,
Matthew 5, verse 39.
But I tell you not to stand up against someone who does you wrong. On the contrary, if someone hits you on the right cheek, let him hit you on the left cheek, give it to him. If someone wants to sue you for your shirt,
Matthew 5, verse 39.
But I tell you not to stand up against someone who does you wrong. On the contrary, if someone hits you on the right cheek.
Ruth, when Boaz is talking with Ruth's kinsman redeemer, or Abraham when he's buying the cave in Machpelah, and they conduct all of their business at the entrance to the city in front of the elders of the city, who have little spots where they would sit right there at the gate of the city. Hey, Joe, you know that blight hit me, my crop pretty hard this year, and the harvest suffered. Our pantry is empty. Could you please spare some food for my family? What? Am I a food pantry? I can't afford to give food to everybody who comes up and asks for it. How will you pay me back? I don't know. I can only hope that next year's hope will be better. I need something sooner than that. Give me your coat. My coat? It's threadbare. It barely keeps me warm at night. What do you want with my coat? I need something, man. Give me your coat. Sure, Joe. All right, here's my coat. Oh, while you're taking clothes that you can't wear, take my shirt, too. Deuteronomy 24. Deuteronomy 24, starting in verse 6. No one may take a mill or even an upper millstone as collateral for a loan, because that would be taking as collateral the debtor's very mean of sustenance. Now you might think, that doesn't apply to me. However, it helps to study discussions about outdated topics to better understand the underlying logic. And I suggest this does apply today. How? How does this apply today? Do you make car payments? Have you ever gotten a car title loan? Do you need that car to get to work every day? How many Americans have a loan and its collateral is the same car they need to make ends meet? What happens if that car is repossessed or impounded? Would God's economy allow that practice? Would it be acceptable to take out a loan on that critical piece of equipment? Would it be acceptable for the bank to repossess it or the police to impound it? Let's go on to the next cycle, the cycle of days. What are the economic prescriptions for every 7 days, for each week? You may not think of it in economic terms, but the Sabbath and the command to observe the Sabbath do have significant economic ramifications. How does God introduce Israel to the Sabbath? And when? Well, it happens before they even arrive at Mount Sinai and receive the Ten Commandments. Let's turn to Exodus 16. Exodus 16, starting in verse 22. Exodus 16, verse 22. On the sixth day, they gathered twice as much bread, 2 omers per person, and all the community leaders came and reported to Moses. He told them, "This is what the Lord has said. Tomorrow is a holy Shabbat for the Lord. Bake what you want to bake, boil what you want to boil, and whatever is left over, set it aside and keep for the morning." They set it aside till morning, as Moses had ordered, and it didn't rot or have worms. Moses said, "Today, eat that.
because today is a Shabbat for the Lord. Today you won't find it in the field. Gather it 6 days, but the seventh day is the Sabbath. On that day there won't be any. The Sabbath isn't just one day out of seven. It's the same day out of seven for the entire community. And the word Shabbat is very closely related to the word for rest. Without the vowel points, it looks the same as Shabbat, the word for rest. Let's turn a couple pages to Exodus 20, verse 8. Exodus 20, verse 8. Remember the day Shabbat to set it apart for God. You have 6 days to labor and do all your work, but the seventh day is a Shabbat for the Lord your God. On it, you are not to do any kind of work. Not you, your son, your daughter, your male slave, your female slave, not your livestock, and not the foreigner staying with you inside the gates to your property. For in 6 days the Lord made heaven and earth, the sea, and everything in them, but on the seventh day he rested. And this is why the Lord blessed the day Shabbat and separated it for himself. Now, where this translation is a little more passive about it, the King James says, 6 days shalt thou labor and do all thy work. And you saw back in Exodus 16, they must go out and collect the bread every day and twice as much on Friday. So even as they are wandering through the desert, they are working every day and resting every Shabbat. God encourages Israel to work throughout the week and rest completely on the Sabbath. Furthermore, in Leviticus 23, God commands a holy convocation on the Sabbath. Where are the economic blessings in the Sabbath? One is a side effect. Everyone works the same 6 days, and everyone comes together for a holy convocation on the seventh. This is a key building block for the community. Have you gone to a church that had morning and afternoon worship services every week? We used to have that here. If you went to morning services, how many of the people that regularly went to afternoon services did you know? Or vice versa, if you went to afternoon, how many of the morning people did you know? During the week, wouldn't you prefer to do business with the folks that you met every week at Shabbat? What's the second blessing? Everyone is working a similar schedule. It's easier to do business with someone if you know when their business is open. How disorienting is it to go to the bank and find out it's closed for some obscure holiday? Or to go to your nail salon and find out that they're closed for Chinese New Year? There's another economic blessing in the Sabbath. When Moses reviews the Ten Commandments in Deuteronomy, he points out how the Sabbath is a reminder. Let's turn to Deuteronomy, Deuteronomy 5. Deuteronomy 5, verse 15. You are to remember that you were a slave in the land of Egypt, and the Lord your God brought you out from there with a strong hand and an outstretched arm. Therefore, the Lord your God has ordered you to keep the day of Shabbat. As slaves in Egypt, the Hebrews had no days of rest. They were expected to work every day without interruption. God not only commands the Israelites to observe the Sabbath, but he also commands their children, their servants, their slaves, and even their livestock to observe the Sabbath. When we come into the kingdom of God, what will the Sabbath look like? How will it feel to see everyone resting on the Sabbath? How will it feel to see every shop shuttered on the Sabbath? How will the community react if an emergency, a fire, flood, an injury happens on the Sabbath? How will we, as spiritual beings, manifest children of God, observe the Sabbath? with the people living in God's kingdom. Will we call together and meet with the carnal population? Or will we come together with our King and the other resurrected children of God?
Let's go to the yearly cycle, the cycle of every year. What are the economic prescriptions for each year? Just as God commanded a holy convocation once a week, he also calls them together three times a year. We've all read Deuteronomy 16:16 multiple times. Several religions practice an annual pilgrimage. God commands three. God doesn't just command an assembly. He encourages an exchange of goods while you're there. So we're in Deuteronomy. Let's turn back to Deuteronomy 14. Deuteronomy 14, starting in verse 22. Deuteronomy 14, verse 22. Every year you must take 1/10 of everything your seed produces in the field and eat it in the presence of the Lord your God. In the place where he chooses to have his name live, you will eat the 10th of your grain, new wine and olive oil and the firstborn of your cattle and sheep, so that you will learn to fear the Lord your God always. But if the distance is too great for you, so that you are unable to transport it because the place where the Lord chooses to put his name is too far from you, then when the Lord your God prospers you, you are to convert it into money. Take the money with you, go to the place which the Lord your God will choose, and exchange the money for anything you want, cattle, sheep, wine, other intoxicating liquor, anything you please. And you are to eat there in the presence of the Lord your God and enjoy yourselves, you and your household. What are you buying there? You're buying someone else's excess. They were able to bring it to the place where God placed his name. You sold your stuff where you are. You brought your money down, and you're buying stuff from them. How many of us have gone to a secular convention and seen unrelated businesses welcoming the attendees on the marquee? Welcome National Association of Music Merchants on a restaurant marquee, right? Perhaps you lived in a town where they hosted such a convention. Have you seen that happen at the feast? I remember going to a few feast sites and seeing different restaurants, and they would have on their marquee, Welcome Worldwide Church of God, or Welcome United Church of God, or Welcome Feast of Tabernacles. And the local community was happy to have us there. Why? Why would they do that? Well, when you get so many people together in one place for a singular purpose, they are an economic boon for the businesses that are there. Now, you'll have to forgive my French. I never studied French, but I'm going to give this a go. During the 12th and 13th centuries, four towns in the Champagne region of France hosted markets throughout the year. In January, the market was in Lagny. During Lent, the market was in Bar-sur-Aube, and in May, it went to Saint-Aillou. In June, it was in Troyes, and in September, it returned to Saint-Aillou, and in October, it returned to Troyes. Each of these market stops specialized in particular trades, reliably providing merchants an opportunity to buy or sell those particular wares. And merchants would come all the way from Britain, all the way from Italy, to come to these merchant conventions, essentially. Some merchants would only go to one of these towns to buy raw goods and sell the finished product, or vice versa. Not only did the merchants benefit from these conventions, but the towns benefited by hosting them, just as today's feast sites economically benefit the local restaurants and hotels. So let's turn to Exodus 34. God promised the children of Israel that he would protect their lands while they were in Jerusalem. Exodus 34, starting in verse 23. Three times a year, all your men are to appear before the Lord, the Lord God of Israel. For I am going to expel nations ahead of you and expand your territory, and no one will even covet your land when you go to appear before the Lord your God three times a year. Now,
There's a Jewish commentary by Rashi who adds, I widen your border, and this way you will be far from the temple, so you cannot constantly appear before me. Therefore, I'm setting these three pilgrimage festivals for you. So just as the Sabbath built up a local community that did business together, so the pilgrimage feasts brought people together from disparate places and gave them a market to sell their excess. Let's go to the economic prescriptions for cycles of years. There were three cycles of years. Let's turn to Deuteronomy 14. For the first cycle, this is a cycle of 3 years. Deuteronomy 14, starting in verse 27. But don't neglect the Levite staying with you, because he has no share or inheritance like yours. At the end of every 3 years, you are to take all the tenths of your produce from that year and store it in your towns. Then the Levite, because he has no share or inheritance like yours, along with the foreigner, the orphan, and the widow living in your towns, will come, eat, and be satisfied, so that the Lord your God will bless you in everything your hands produce. This is the third tithe, or the poor tithe. Let's turn to where God repeats it in Deuteronomy, and this is in Deuteronomy 26. Deuteronomy 26, verse 12. After you have separated a tenth of the crops yielded in the third year, and I'm in Deuteronomy 26, 12. In the third year, the year of separating a tenth, and have given it to the Levite, the foreigner, the orphan, and the widow, so that they can have enough food to satisfy them while staying with you, you are to say, in the presence of the Lord your God, I have rid myself, or have rid my house of the things set aside for God, and given them to the Levite, the foreigner, the orphan, and the widow, in keeping with every one of the commandments you gave me. I haven't disobeyed any of your commandments or forgotten them. I haven't eaten any of this food when mourning. I haven't put any of it aside when unclean, nor have I given any of it for the dead. I have listened to what the Lord my God has said, and I have done everything you have ordered me to do. Look out from your holy dwelling place from heaven and bless your people Israel and the land you gave us as you swore to our ancestors, a land flowing with milk and honey. As rabbinical Jews practiced the cycle of 3 years, they consolidated it with the second cycle, the cycle of 7 years. Every seventh year was a year of release. Let's turn to Exodus 23. Exodus 23, starting in verse 10. Exodus 23:10 reads, "For 6 years you are to sow your land with seed and gather in its harvest. But the seventh year you are to let it rest and lie fallow, so that the poor among your people can eat, and what they leave the wild animals in the countryside can eat. Do the same with your vineyard and your olive grove." And again, you know, we see God being compassionate to the people that are underprivileged, to the Levite, the stranger, the widow, the orphan. Let's turn to Leviticus 25 and look at where God repeats this. Leviticus 25, starting in verse 3. Leviticus 25, 3. 6 years you will sow your field. 6 years you will prune your grapevines and gather their produce. But in the seventh year is to be a Shabbat of complete rest for the land. A Shabbat for the Lord. You will neither sow your field nor prune your grapevines. You are not to harvest what grows by itself from the seeds left by your previous harvest. And you are not to gather the grapes of your untended vine. It is to be a year of complete rest for the land. But what the land produces during the year of Shabbat will be food for all of you. You, your servant, your maid, your employee, anyone living near you, your livestock and the wild animals on your land, everything the land produces may be used for food. So how did the Jews consolidate these two cycles, the cycle of three and the cycle of seven?
Well, in the first year of seven, you brought your second tithe with you to the feast and spent it on whatever your heart desired. And in the second year of seven, you brought your second tithe with you to the feast and spent it on whatever your heart desired. But in the third year of seven, you donated your second tithe to the widow, the orphan, the Levite, and the stranger in your local community. This is the poor tithe. The fourth and fifth years in the seven-year cycle were like the first and second, and the sixth year in the seven-year cycle was like the third. The seventh year was similar to the third and sixth, except everyone left their fields fallow, so everyone lived off the produce of the previous year and whatever the land produced on its own. So how did you observe the pilgrimage feasts in the third and sixth years? Did the community pool its resources and trek to the feast together? Did you keep a smaller feast in your local area? Which do you think is appropriate? Leave your comments in the section below. That seventh year, it's called Shanat HaShemitah in Hebrew, the year of release. And by extension from the root word, which is Strong's number 8058, that's 8058, the year of laying fallow. In Deuteronomy 15, let's turn there. In Deuteronomy 15, we see it was more than a year of release releasing the land from work. It was also a year to release debtors from debt and slaves from slavery. Deuteronomy 15, verse 1. At the end of every 7 years, you are to have a Shemitah. Here is how the Shemitah is to be done. Every creditor is to give up what he has loaned to his fellow member of the community. He is not to force his neighbor or relative to repay it, because the Lord's time of remission has been proclaimed. You may demand that a foreigner repay his debt, but you are to release your claim on whatever your brother owes you. In spite of this, there will be no one needy among you, because the Lord will certainly bless you in the land which the Lord your God is giving you as an inheritance to possess, if only you will listen carefully to what the Lord your God says and take care to obey all of these commandments I am giving you today. Yes, the Lord your God will bless you as he promised you, and you will lend money to many nations without having to borrow, and you will rule over many nations without their ruling over you. If someone among you is needy, one of your brothers, in any of your towns in your land which the Lord your God is giving you, you are not to harden your heart or shut your hand from giving to your needy brother. No, you must open your hand to him and lend him enough to meet his need and enable him to obtain what he wants. Guard yourself against allowing your heart to entertain the mean-spirited thought that because the seventh year, the year of Shemitah, is at hand, you would be stingy toward your needy brother and not give him anything, for then he might cry out to the Lord against you, and it will be your sin. Rather, you must give to him, and you are not to be grudging when you give to him. If you do this, the Lord your God will bless you in all your work and everything you undertake, for there will always be poor people in the land. That is why I'm giving you this order. You must open your hand to your poor and needy brother in your land. So God promises a blessing if we follow these commandments. There will be no one needy among you. But then he goes on and says, there will always be poor people in the land. How can both be true? So one of the commentaries says, when you perform the will of the omnipresent, there will be needy among others, but not among you. If, however, you do not perform the will of the omnipresent, there will be needy among you. Let's turn to Amos chapter 9. Someone else quoted this recently, and I thought it was pertinent. Amos 9, verse 13. The days will come, says the Lord, when the plowman will overtake the reaper, and the one treading grapes, the one sowing seed.
Sweet wine will drip down the mountains, and all the hills will flow with it. I will restore the fortunes of my people Israel. They will build and inhabit the ruined cities. They will plant vineyards and drink their wine, cultivate gardens and eat their fruit. I will plant them on their own soil, no more to be uprooted from their land, which I gave them, says the Lord your God. Let's look at the last cycle. This is the cycle of the Jubilee, and turn back to Leviticus 25. Leviticus 25, starting in verse 8. You are to count 7 Shabbats of years, 7 times 7 years, that is 49 years. Then on the 10th day of the 7th month on Yom Kippur, you are to sound a blast on the shofar. You are to sound the shofar all through your land, and you are to consecrate the 50th year, proclaiming freedom throughout the land to all its inhabitants. It will be a yovel for you. You will return everyone to the land he owns, and everyone is to return to his family. That 50th year will be a yovel to you. In that year, you are not to sow, harvest what grows by itself, or gather the grapes of untended vines, because it is a yovel. It will be holy for you. Whatever the fields produce will be food for all of you. In this year of yovel, every one of you is to return to the land he owns. Now, let's set aside the argument about whether this should happen every 49 years or 50 years and focus instead on the economic blessing. God commands in Leviticus 25, so we're still in Leviticus 25, verse 14, God commands that the people should return to their own land every year of Jubilee, every Yovel. In verse 14, we read, if you sell anything to your neighbor or buy anything from him, neither of you is to exploit the other. Rather, you are to take into account the number of years after the Yovel when you buy land from your neighbor, and he is to sell to you according to the number of years crops will be raised. If the number of years remaining is large, you will raise the price. If few years remain, you will lower it, because what he is really selling you is the number of crops to be produced. Thus, you are not to take advantage of each other, but you are to fear your God, for I am the Lord your God. God commands buyer and seller to base the price of the land on its usufruct, the amount that land would produce before the land is returned. Is it a large tract? Is it a fruitful tract? Is it good for grazing? How many years remain before the next yovel? How is the yovel an economic blessing? The yovel was a reset that happened roughly every 2 generations, and it prevented a family from becoming helplessly stuck in poverty, what is today called generational poverty. It prevented huge disparities between the rich and the poor. Let's go down further in this chapter to verse 29. Since the price of the land was based on its usufruct, God made certain exceptions. In verse 29, we read, if someone sells a dwelling in a walled city, he has 1 year after the date of sale in which to redeem it. For a full year, he will have the right of redemption. But if he has not redeemed the dwelling in the walled city within the year, then title in perpetuity passes to the buyer through all his generations. It will not revert in the yovel. However, houses and villages not surrounded by walls are to be dealt with like the fields in the countryside. They may be redeemed before the yovel, and they revert in the yovel. This is one place where we need to get out of our modern mindset, our modern context, and pay attention to the context in which the Bible was written. What was different back then? How did a house in the city during biblical times differ from a house in the city today? How did a house in the city during biblical times differ from a house in the village or the country? Houses in the city were more like small apartments today. You shared your wall with your neighbor. There was no space in between.
You shared a courtyard with the whole block and ate meals together in the evening. Your first floor was the shop, maybe something like a bodega, and your living quarters were upstairs, where a house in the country would have like a four-room plan or something along those lines, and you'd enter in and there'd be this hallway in down the middle, and you'd have a room on this side and a room on that side and a room in the back and a ladder going up to the roof. So you had a full house separated into different rooms, and you could be a mile away from your nearest neighbor. And in a village, you tended to have distinct buildings if you weren't surrounded by a wall. But once that city had that wall built around it, things started getting cramped, and people started living with, you know, eight neighbors or so on the one block. Since land was sold based on usufruct, how much could a house in a city produce throughout the year? Not much. If someone had to sell his apartment in the city, God gave him a year to redeem it, probably by returning to his family's land and saving the necessary capital. Let's look further down in this chapter, go down to verse 47, Leviticus 25, verse 47. How did the Yovel impact foreigners? Starting in verse 47, we see, if a foreigner living with you has grown rich, and a member of your people has become poor and sells himself to this foreigner living with you, or to a member of the foreigner's family, he may be redeemed after he has been sold. One of his brothers may redeem him, or his uncle's son may redeem him, or any near relative of his may redeem him, or if he becomes rich, he may redeem himself. He will calculate with the person who bought him the time from the year he sold himself to the year of Yovel, and the amount to be paid will be according to the number of years and his time at an employee's wage. If many years remain, according to them, will he refund the amount for his redemption from the amount he was bought for. If there remain only a few years until the year of Yovel, then he will calculate with them according to his years, will he refund the amount for his redemption. He will be like a worker hired year for year. You will see to it that he is not treated harshly. If he has not been redeemed by any of these procedures, nevertheless, he will go free in the year of Yovel, he and his children with him. So we've reviewed all of these different cycles. We've reviewed the cycle of days, the cycle every day, the cycle of every week, the cycle of every year, and these cycles of years. How does man's economic system, how has every manly economic system fallen short of God's? And why don't any of these systems work? All of our mortal, manly, carnal economic systems have privileged classes and oppressed classes. But man's economic systems do more to perpetuate the hegemony of the privileged classes than they do to improve the condition of the oppressed. Several governments today exercise a capitalist economy and provide some accommodation for their less privileged, but all of these governments fall short of God's ideal economy. Why is it important to improve the condition of the oppressed? History has lost count of the number of times slaveholding economies have been turned upside down, the former slaves now enslaving their former masters. History records several peasant revolts. The last 200 years have seen a new phenomenon where the intelligentsia promises redistribution of wealth to incite rebellion by the oppressed. But socialism rewards idleness and punishes industry. So these revolutions have always produced tyrannical, impoverished, murderous governments. God does not permit generational slavery. One can choose to be a slave for life, but no one can force it on another. God does not separate his people into classes. God discourages idleness. Rather, he encourages his people to be industrious, to make profit selling among themselves and loan money to foreigners.
This sets God's economy apart from man's slave, feudalist, communist, socialist, and caste economies. God's law consistently reminds us to consider the estate of the less privileged, identified in the law as the widow, the orphan, the stranger, and the Levite. Who should be included in that list today? God instituted resets to prevent huge disparities between the rich and the poor. Capitalism has a lot going for it, but it must be tempered by accommodations for those who are less fortunate. God consistently makes accommodations for the downtrodden. Don't take the millstone as collateral. If you have to shutter your shop in town, you have the right to buy it back at a reasonable price up to a year later. If you have to serve someone else to make ends meet, they have to let you go the next Shemitah. If you have to sell your family land because of a drought or a blight, it will be returned to your family at the next Yovel. Yes, God wants us to be industrious and wealthy. And he wills that none of his children should be poor or oppressed. As we see in Acts and Paul's epistles, God rejoices when we share our blessings as aid for brothers and sisters who are in distress. Just as God's kingdom will accommodate the less fortunate tomorrow, so we today should afford those accommodations within our communities. Let's turn for the last couple of scriptures in 1 Kings 4. We'll start in 1 Kings 4 and read verse 25. 1 Kings 4, verse 25. You seem to have something off here because I'm looking at 1 Kings 4 and I only see 20 verses. Did I miss? Is it 14:25? That doesn't seem right either. Okay. Well, it's somewhere in 1 Kings. because of the context here. And it reads, wherever it is, from Dan to Beersheba, Judah and Israel lived securely, every man under his vine and fig tree throughout the lifetime of Solomon. Oh, here it is. I'm reading a different Bible. And there's a chapter break after verse 20. Okay. And then to reiterate that, so this is how it was during Israel's most prosperous time under a mortal leader, Solomon. If we look in Micah 4:4, we see a similar promise. We'll close with Micah chapter 4, verse 4. Instead, each person will sit under his vine and fig tree, with no one to upset him, for the mouth of the Lord of hosts has spoken.